Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon from sunny Texas. I'm not going to say it's warm Texas, but it is sunny, at least in some parts. It's very cool down here in Texas. We have been experiencing the winter. I heard the other day that it was halfway through winter. I'm very excited about that. For some reason, it seems like December and January have been very, very, very cold, and I can't seem to get used to that. As a tennis person, I'm always looking forward to getting back out onto the tennis court. It just doesn't seem to be happening on a regular basis. Recently, whether it be the cold under 32-degree weather, the rain, the freezing rain, the sleet, or the snow that seems to be happening that keeps you from getting out there, that happens on a regular basis down here, polar vortex, whatever it is called, keeps you away from the tennis court, that's for sure. So I'm excited that we're halfway through the winter months. I heard the other day that Punxsutawney Phil did see his shadow, so we got 6 more weeks of winter. Although I can't understand how in Pennsylvania, how if he sees a shadow up there, that affects us here in Texas, but we'll work with it. So I want to congratulate you on finding us today. If you're listening live, this is the UR Tennis Network. This is Jason Haynes. I am the host of the American College Experience. This is a show that is dedicated to college tennis. It has been this way for About 3 years. It used to be called Diversity in College Tennis, and we changed the name just under a year ago to give you a little different experience in the world of college tennis. And today we're definitely going to get a different experience in relation to college tennis. I'm excited about today's show. We've got a friend in the college tennis world, and Bill Riddle, who will come on here in a little while, and he's going to talk about some NAIA tennis. A world of tennis that is very regularly, it's just not talked about a lot. And Bill's going to help us explore that world in just a little bit. If this is your first time joining the show, congratulations. We talk a lot of tennis here on the UR Tennis Network. Normally Monday mornings, we have our Parenting Aces show with Lisa Goodman-Stone. She is out of Atlanta, Georgia. She talks a lot about raising a kid in the tennis world, junior tennis. She comes on 11 o'clock Central Standard Time. If you missed the show that comes on before me, American Tennis with Coach Chuck Creasy. Coach is the head men's coach over at the Citadel. Used to be at Clemson University. He's a wonderful host. He's trying to figure out what's wrong or what's right with American tennis. There's my show, and then also on Saturday we have Infinite Tennis with Bill Patton. Bill is out in California, and he does a wonderful job of exploring the West Coast. So into the college tennis world we'll go. It always seems to happen a Tuesday afternoon. I don't know why this is. I think they wait because they know that I like to talk about college tennis news. But last Tuesday afternoon when I got around and searching the Internet for stories and things, I found an interesting article out there about one of our former guests He did come on the show a while back and loved having him on. I've talked to him several times. His name is Luke Jensen. Luke resigned from the University of Syracuse. He came to the university in August of 2006. And he came to the university with a great dream there. He was going to use American players with professional aspirations to turn around a program up there in the Big East at the time to kind of turn it into a prestigious tennis university, let these young ladies come over there, get a great education, and transform it into kind of a professional superhighway. In his 7 years there, he had a winning record, 6 of the 7 years, with a 106-54 winning record. He did a good job over there. His girls did play professional tennis tournaments. He was able to get them out there on the WTA Tour and help them with his knowledge of the professional tour. You know, it's hard. He was an ESPN commentator as well. He did garner some national spotlight in that. He wanted to pursue, return to the National Tennis Arena and pursue some new opportunities, and we want to wish him best of luck. He's got a great tennis mind and comes from a wonderful tennis family. You know, his brother Murphy is the head coach there at the Washington Castles there as the World Team Tennis team, and the Jensens have been around American tennis and driven some great tennis opportunities through their time, and want to wish him the best. Now, if you were able to listen in to last week's show, we had Steve Denton on the show. Steve, the coach there at Texas A&M University. Today, February the 4th, National Signing Day for you football fans out there and other sports as well. But Division I men's ranking came out, and I want to share with you that for the fourth straight week, Virginia sits atop the men's rankings with UCLA, who played a great weekend of tennis on the Pac-12 network. They beat USC and Georgia. Georgia, they beat 4-3. Then behind them sits USC and Georgia, number 5, Ohio State, 6, Baylor, number 7, Oklahoma, 8, Texas A&M, and as I remember last week, Coach Denton said they were 9, so they keep moving up there a little bit. 9, Mississippi State, and 10, the University of Texas has made a move up into the top 10. So for me here in Texas, that's 3 schools inside the state of Texas that are inside the top 10. 2 of those are Big 12 schools, 1 an SEC school, so very good to see. On the women's side, there is no new ranking, and that's because the women are playing the national indoor, and they agreed not to put out a team ranking this week because of that. So we're operating on last week's ranking, number 1, Stanford, 2, Florida, 3, North Carolina, 4, Georgia, number 5, UCLA, number 6, USC, number 7, Texas A&M, number 8, Cal, number 9, Miami, and number 10, Duke. We're going to talk about that ITA indoor here in just a little bit, but I want to remind you that I get a lot of my information from the itatennis.com site. And on that site, if you'll go there, you'll get to see a nice edition that they put up there called ITA Match Day Central. And what the ITA has done has tried to centralize all matches from all divisions. You can go there and follow your team. And they put the live match scores on there, and they have video available if your team does that, and you can follow them. They've got stats on there as well. All divisions are represented there, Division 2, 3. I've seen the JUCO matches advertised there. They keep it about 2 weeks out, 10 days out, so you can check your team out there if you'd like and keep track of it. now that ITA indoor. Now, remember, the women's tournament is this week, and then the men's tournament, men playing on Valentine's Day the next week down in Houston. February 7th through the 10th at Boar's Head Sports Club in Charlottesville, Virginia. Remember, what was unique about the women's teams here is 14 of the 15 number one seeds from the kickoff weekend made it. Only Vanderbilt, which was a number three seed, they beat Nebraska, the number one seed out of their region. They were the giant killers to make it into that team tournament. Five conferences are represented. The ACC sent five teams. The SEC sent five teams. The Pac-12 sent three. The Big Ten sent two, and the Big 12 just sent one team. You've got teams from, you got the University of Florida, Texas A&M, North Carolina, Cal, Michigan, Northwestern, Duke, Virginia, Georgia, USC, UCLA, Miami, Alabama, Clemson, and Texas. So that tournament's played through Monday. We'll have the winner Monday, so we'll be able to announce the winner of that when we get back on the air next week. I'm very excited to have the opportunity there to get the winner announced whenever we get back out on the air next week. So looks like we've got Bill holding on here. Now, I want to remind you that this is a call-in show. If you're out there listening and you got a question today for Bill or myself and want to call in, that number again is 714-583-6853. So feel free to call in and ask a question. Let me see if I can bring him in here. Hi, Bill. Are you there?
Hey, Jason. How's it going, buddy?
Fine today. A little bit chilly here in Texas. How about where you're at in Tennessee?
Yeah, it's low 30s here and a little overcast, so not exactly ideal tennis weather, but, you know, spring will be here soon.
I keep hearing that. Are you sure about that?
Well, that's what the experts say, so you got to go with what they're feeding us.
Well, I hope you're right about that. Now, Bill, I always start my broadcast off here. You know, we've got to find out a little bit about my guests and who they are. So if you would, please introduce yourself to my tennis listeners.
Well, I'm the director of tennis at a private country club here in the Middle Tennessee area, Bluegrass Yacht and Country Club, where I've been the director of tennis for the last 16 years. And some people ask me, you know, how do you have a yacht club in the middle of Tennessee? And it's pretty simple because, you know, in Tennessee, if you have at least two canoes tied up on the lake, you qualify as a yacht club. So that's us. But been around for about 26 years in the tennis business, coached college tennis for quite a number of years, and pretty much tennis is kind of my life and what I do. So,
now, Bill, yeah, we connected. I put out a feeler here through my Facebook, and we connected this way. And the interesting thing about this is you have quite a bit of college experience in your resume. And what's unique about it is your experience tends to be connected to the NAIA level.
Yeah, you know, I spent pretty much all my time, other than a short period, coaching at a Division III school, but most of my time was at the NAIA level. And from what I have seen and experienced, you know, the NAIA level of college tennis tends to get overlooked. Unless you have played there yourself, you just don't really know much about it. It's kind of this wasteland of tennis.
You know, I completely agree with that the NAIA level is often overlooked, and a lot of people just don't quite understand you know much about it. So let's just start off with, what does the NAIA stand for? What does the NA and the IA stand for?
Well, National, let's see here, Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, I believe.
Yeah, you're exactly
remember,
right about that.
If I remember
that.
Correctly. Put me on the spot there.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to right off the bat. I had to quiz you. Now, the schools that you coached at the NAIA level, what were they?
I spent some time as assistant at Belmont when they were at the NAIA level before they moved up to Division One, and then I moved over to Fisk University, which was Division Three at the time. And then spent the majority of my time at Cumberland University, which is in just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, which has always been an NAIA school. For us, being centrally located here in Tennessee and in the Southeast, you know, for us, we played pretty much everybody up and down the ladder from top JUCO teams up to Division One teams that were, you know, in our immediate vicinity.
Now, these NAIA jobs, I mean, Bill, help me understand this. Were you a full-time coach at these schools? Were you a part-time coach, or how did this work for you?
Well, I spent most of my time coaching college tennis, doing it all. Also, at the same time, I was teaching at a club. You know, majority of the NAIA schools will have a full part-time, we'll call it. Because you can't really coach college tennis part-time. I don't know that you can really coach any kind of tennis part-time. But you know, you're out there recruiting as much as you can. If you want to be competitive, you know, you're getting part-time pay with full-time workload.
I realize that. There's a lot of that. You know, people don't quite understand that a lot of those small college experiences are driven by people with passion for their sports. You know, and tennis is that way. You're out there giving it, like you say, that full-time experience, but getting part-time pay. Were you the men's and the women's coach?
I was. I coached both the men's and the women's teams at all the stops that I was at, and still, you know, held down a club job. I was fortunate because my club was is more of a seasonal club. So, you know, in January, February, and March, when you're hitting it hard on the college scene, that was absolutely the slowest time for me at my club. So I was very, very fortunate in that respect, and not everyone gets to do that, but I kind of found the right school and the right opportunity, and for a while was able to really make it work, and we were pretty competitive at the NAIA level.
Well, that's where I've noticed, you know, and I appreciate the modesty, Bill. Pretty competitive. I mean, I looked at some of the things you were nationally ranked in your programs there.
Yeah, we were very fortunate. I think because of my connections, over the years as a tennis teaching professional, and have a lot of good friends all over the globe, you know, I was able to utilize those relationships to bring in players pretty much from all over, and put together guys and girls squads that were competitive. You know, we had some national ranked teams every year at various positions, some nationally ranked singles and doubles players as well, and you know, we're able to put together some pretty good success for program that, you know, we just really didn't have the funding, but we found ways to kind of make it work.
Yeah, now when you talk about these schools, I mean, Fisk and Belmont and Cumberland, these aren't, you know, as I mentioned, the Division I schools, Virginia, North Carolina, Stanford, and so on and so forth. I mean, how big of schools are we talking about here in relation to student size?
Well, at Fisk, I know you've got less than, 500, 600 students there. at Cumberland, we were less than 1,800 students. Size doesn't necessarily matter always, or at least that's what they say. But we were fortunate in that we found the right kids and got them into the right environment. And some young players are looking for a smaller environment. They don't want to be on a campus with 20,000 kids. So you just have to find those individuals out.
And there are some definite advantages to being an athlete, a student athlete on a small campus. I mean, with the relative, student to teacher ratio, with being recognized as a student athlete, I mean, you get a lot of notoriety on the campus and other aspects, I'm sure, as well, right?
Well, yeah, I believe that's one of the things that's overlooked a lot of times. From American kids that are interested in playing college tennis, I think that's one of the things they overlook, that, at the NAIA level, you can go and play and be kind of a big fish in a small pond sometimes. You get a lot of personal attention, from the school that has less than 2,000 students in it. Professors are much easier to work with, and they're more accommodating when it comes to travel. I was very fortunate that we never really had any issues when it came to to missing a class or being away at an event or something like that, because that student athlete was one of 15 in the classroom, and we had a real good relationship with each one of the professors. So it felt like more of a real team and family approach because of the size of the school, as opposed to, some of the bigger universities.
Now, with the schools being smaller schools, I mean, were they located in bigger towns, or how were the towns situated?
Well, it's funny, a lot of these schools, even to the Division III level, and even some Division II schools, they're out of the way a little bit. For us, Cumberland University was, in a little town called Lebanon, which is, maybe 15, 20 minutes away from Nashville, downtown Nashville, and the airport. So it's kind of tucked away in a small town, but you also have a big city life right down the road. And that's a lot of the schools that are out there. I mean, we traveled the Southeast playing schools at, very similar situation. You go down to Barry, which is located right outside of Atlanta, or Shorter College, which was just outside of Atlanta. And, you've got a lot of schools that are similar to that are in and around larger cities, but they're just kind of in a little bit of a smaller town.
Now, the big difference between each of the divisions tends to rely on athletic scholarships. Division I, they're giving away 4.5 full scholarships. Division III, they don't give away any athletic scholarships, period. It's all academic. So help us understand at the NAIA level, what sort of scholarship situations did you have?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because it varies. We would play 20 matches in the springtime. I think the max was 24 at the time. We would roughly get in about 20 or so matches. And in that schedule, we would play teams that, didn't have but one full scholarship to divide amongst all the players on say, the guys' team. And then you'd go play someone like Freed Hardeman at the time, before they dropped their tennis program. They had 6 full scholarships. So it's a little bit, I don't want to say unfair, but it's just a little bit uneven, because it's up to the school to put in the amount of money that they want to that particular program. And, I think we had 3.5 scholarships at the time, full scholarships, that we could divide up. which is not bad. I mean, it's not great, but it's not bad. So it really is an unlevel playing field at the NAI level, and that's probably the biggest hurdle that I think you have to face when you're competing at that level.
So at the NAI level, and just help me understand this, on the men and the women's side, you could have up to 6 full scholarships?
Well, I don't know about officially, but I know that some programs had had more than others, say. And that's just the way it is. I mean, it's just like if you play at the Division I level, you've got an even playing field on scholarships, but you also have an uneven playing field on facilities and support staff and things like that.
Well, I think we should preface this, that maybe we should say in your time, Bill. I mean, and you've been out of, you know, understanding about the NAIA level for a time now, so the rules have changed and things like that. So, you know, just trying to understand what it was during your time at the NAIA level. Now, with the full scholarship situation, I mean, we were talking, you know, and just to understand, I mean, we're talking about room, board, books, tuition, fees, that sort of full scholarship, right?
Right. I mean, you would have a full academic and housing that was combined in there as well. And, you know, and I think sometimes what you have to look at, too, in the case of some of the schools that maybe have dropped their program, they were putting a lot of money and resources into those programs, and sometimes not a lot of return. I mean, if you look back at some of the schools that have dropped, there's been quite a few at the NAI level that have dropped their program or really cut back. And there's Union University that was here in Tennessee, like I said, Fried Hardeman, that was a very solid program, a top nationally ranked program at the time. Every school kind of could do what they wanted to and put more resources into it, and some of them have kind of gone by the wayside, unfortunately.
And we've seen that a lot in the small college world, and it's hard to watch as a tennis person. I mean, we know historically that tennis people are the ones that tend to give back to the schools and through the alumni the most. They've done studies on it at the Division I level and other levels as well, and it's really kind of like shooting yourself in the foot because, you know, as you get older, the people that have the money are the tennis people and the golf people. So when you go around cutting these programs and you cut the tennis and golf and you keep the football and the basketball people, and then you want people to give money back to the school, they're wondering, well, why don't you have a tennis and golf program? So, that's going to end up hurting a lot of these schools in the long run. So when you see these programs drop, whether it be an NAIA level or Division I level, I mean, as you look at it, is it strictly money related? I mean, on the scholarship side of things, or do you see other reasons out there as to why they might be dropping the programs?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons. To be competitive at the, we'll call it the elite level of college tennis, I mean, you're trying to put the very, very best players into those spots out there, and a lot of times we're finding that they're foreign players that are coming over and playing in those spots, and which is fine, but the reality is a lot of times they're not the ones who are coming back and supporting the university and alumni dollars, so that becomes a bit of an issue. I've seen several smaller colleges have to drop programs because of facilities. You know, they just did not have the money to invest another, $500,000 into upgrading tennis courts or locker rooms and things like that, and maintaining the tennis facilities. So that becomes a bit of an issue. So I mean, I don't know that you can just put the blame on a particular thing. I think it's a combination of things, and for some schools and some areas of the country, it's different, but they seem to all be in the same kind of a mix.
Now, at the small college level, when it pertains to budgets, did you feel like you were fully funded? I mean, did you get what you were after? Did you have to fundraise some there? How did that work for you, Bill?
Well, for us, I took a little bit of a different approach. I mean, when I got there, the school had the tennis players, guys and girls, almost, you know, I kind of refer to it as the high school approach. I mean, they were out hawking candy bars and selling snacks at the local hockey arena and doing things like that, which I'm not going to knock it. It just wasn't what I had envisioned for our program. So we were able to find ways to generate revenue through connecting with the local tennis community. I mean, we always had a fall tennis program where we were engaging the community and getting them out there to meet our players and you know, connect with our program, but also generating money through participation fees and sponsorship. So for us, that was pretty huge to do that every year. Additionally, our players didn't necessarily like this, but instead of traveling in the springtime to play a tournament, we turned it around and hosted our own here in Nashville, and we would catch a lot of those teams coming down from the north headed to Hilton Head or Florida, and we would have our own tournament, once again, save some money but also make some money off of our own event. So, I found ways to generate revenue that were more on the court or tied to the program than just out there. But there's a lot of schools that are they have to go out there and beg and borrow a lot of times and sell candy bars to be able to make it, because, at the small college level, you just do not have the funding to be able to run a program and be competitive at the higher levels. I mean, if you don't mind being, the 35th ranked team in the country, that's fine. But if you want to be inside the top 15, you're going to have to put forth some effort and raise some funding to be able to get to that.
It's true on a lot of levels there, and we noticed that in order to attract players on whether it be international or American, that it helps to have a ranking, and a ranking that continues to move up. I mean, you being there in the middle of Tennessee, and you do have a lot of small colleges around you. Do you find that the small colleges are attractive, to the Americans in the area?
Well, it's a little bit of a sales job that you have to do as a coach, especially if you're, when you go and you talk to that young man or young woman when they're in the high school ranks, a little bit of a sales job to get them to, take a look at your small school as opposed to, a bigger Division II school. And, a lot of times they want to know how many kids are on campus and, kind of what campus life is like. And it is completely different at a small school. But that doesn't make it good or bad. It's just different. And I think you just have to seek out those kids looking for that opportunity and experience, and just give them all the pros and cons. I was very – we had a lot of foreign players that come through our program, but we also had a lot of local American talent that, I was able to cultivate and, through my connections as a tennis teaching professional, be able to kind of cultivate that and find ways to bring them in. I'll be honest, I think the happiest I've ever been from a coaching standpoint is winning our conference and regional title with our girls team that, four of the top seven were American girls that were from the state of Tennessee. So for me, that was huge to be able to do that.
I mean, there's a lot about a small college atmosphere. I mean, for a lot of kids, it's closer to home. I mean, there tends to be a little bit more scholarship money for these Americans. And a lot of times there's more chances to play, don't you think?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think, having local players come in, I mean, we were able to find local sources of scholarship money. There's so much scholarship money out there athletically and academically that goes unused, and you don't really realize that until you're sitting in that seat trying to find players to take that money, or working with the school that has resources. I know at our school we had about 80 different scholarships that were not tied to anything other than just specifics, endowments, scholarships that if you graduated from XYZ school, you could qualify for an extra $1,000 or whatnot. So every school has those. They're really under the radar, but it's finding the kids that want to get matched up to that. And local kids, local players, a lot of times you can find those alternate sources of scholarship money, and it really stretches what you can do with your program.
And Bill, you've been in small college tennis for a while, so tell me, how did you approach the international versus American experience? I mean, you've had international kids on your teams. I mean, how did you find them, and how did you like having them on your teams? I mean, help me out.
Well, I once again, I'll go back and say I was very fortunate. I mean, after 26 years of being in the tennis industry, we've got a lot of good friends all over the globe that had a player that they were coaching, or their son or their daughter, or I'm not a big fan of recruiting services a lot of times, because I don't know that you're truly getting all the right information. And so building those relationships with coaches who could find me a player from Mexico or Sweden or Canada, to me that's what it was about, because my coaching philosophy was a little bit different. It was, really about building a relationship with those players, and I still weekly stay in touch with former players everywhere from Vancouver to Australia to Europe. Those kids are still part of my extended family, and for me it was just about building that big giant family of tennis players and people.
Now let me remind our listeners out there, if you want to call in, you've got a question, call in at 583-6853. Again, that's 714-583-6853. Bill, did you notice a big difference in the attitude or the desire of those international kids versus the American?
Well, I may catch a little heat for this, but my experience, and I can only share my experience, but mine has been that, the American kids are a little bit spoiled. They want a little more than they maybe deserve. Foreign players will tend to come in and, almost run through a brick wall for you if that's what it takes to get on the team and get money for books or get money to, to go to school there. It's just a different mentality. And once again, I'll go back and say this was from my experience of, roughly 9 years or so of coaching at that level. It's just a different mindset that the foreign player has versus the American player. And I'll say this, it's a lot to do with the parents. A lot of American parents, they really think Johnny or Sally is way better than they really are. And they deserve way more money than they should be getting. And that's a lot of times where the issues might have come from.
Now, at the NAIA level, did you notice in particular, any international groups coming from one particular area or the other, or were they just kind of all over the place?
Well, I think some schools will develop, a pipeline to a particular place. We had several kids that were Brazilian that played for us, and everyone's got a friend back home that would like to play, and a lot of times that's where you're going to find some of your best players. A current player is going to lead you to someone back in their hometown or their home country. But we probably had, 15 different countries represented, from Uzbekistan to Kenya, you know, to Antigua, Jamaica, you know, countries that maybe are not necessarily on the tennis radar, but we were able to find good, solid players that were looking for an opportunity to play, get a good education, and be a part of a team, and we were able to do that pretty successfully.
Now, Bill, you've been watching tennis, college tennis, professional tennis, and otherwise for a good while now, and you know, I have to ask. I mean, do you think college tennis is contributing to a push in American professional tennis, or is it leading to somewhat of a downfall in tennis? I mean, and I'll share it. You know, on the women's side, we've shared this with some of the top women's college coaches out there. You know, we understand that women are maturing differently than the men. You know, we don't get the – usually the women are deciding before college if they want to be professional or not, so that's why we don't see a lot of the college players on the women's side turning professional. But on the men's side, when we look at the rankings, I think we've got six in the top 100. A lot of them have played college tennis, but when you look at kind of where we're at as far as American tennis goes, and when you look at the Davis Cup performance coming off this last weekend, man, we're really hurting on the American side of professional tennis. So, I mean, have you got some feelings about this?
Well, I think the thing that most people don't realize is that there's so many different levels of college and professional tennis. You know, it's just so many different things, factors go into you know, those players developing. When are they going to develop? I mean, you look at players like John Isner, and you know, had a good college career, and he's done well in the pros. And you look back, and there's been other players. I mean, I won't mention any names, but there've been other players that have turned pro instead of going to college. And you know, maybe they make it, maybe they don't. You know, it really is up to the individual. I mean, you've got some other good kids out there. I mean, like a Bobby Reynolds or Tennis Sandgren. You know, they spent time, Rajiv Ram spent time in the college ranks that, you know, they developed. You know, had they come out earlier, would they be where they are now? Maybe, maybe not. It's really hard to look into that, you know, crystal ball and be able to give a definitive answer as to where they're going to be. But I think that the most important thing to keep in mind is that it's really dependent on that particular person, that particular player. I don't know that these players that are playing college tennis is and not going to the pros or vice versa is hurting or helping us, but I think it goes beyond that. I mean, we've got to continue to grow our numbers of players and grow the sport as a sport where athletes want to come play. I mean, I've said this for years, and others have said the same thing. I mean, I'd rather have an athlete out there on the court and teach them how to play tennis than just a tennis player who's not as athletic. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of factors that kind of come into play there.
Well, Bill, you must have been reading my mind, and I think that's where that next question is going to go. I mean, are we just missing the boat as far as athletes go? I mean, you look at – and we just come off the Super Bowl. I mean, if Richard Sherman has a racket in his hand, or Russell Wilson at the right moment in this maturity thing, I mean, are we looking at national champions there as far, or world champions there as far as tennis players go?
Well, I mean, it's sure thing that if you're an athlete, if you have athletic abilities, you can do a little bit of anything. And I'll take a prime example. We have a local charity event we do here in Nashville, and I've had a couple of current and former Tennessee Titans football players come out, and for the majority of them have never played tennis, and come out and in a period of a morning, you know, develop into a pretty decent little tennis player. Now, you know, athletic development or just the ability to be an athlete on the court, it will take you a long way. And And unfortunately, I think we are not building athletes, and it kind of goes all the way back to our school system. You know, kids aren't in PE, they're not having gym, they're not having play time. So, you know, from an early development period, we're not, you know, giving them the things they need to develop early enough. And I think all those things kind of come into play that we've got to do a better job of developing younger athletes, you know, kids that are, you know, growing up playing soccer. I mean, I've said this also for years that, I mean, when that kid turns 4 or 5, they need to go out there and just play soccer for a few years and learn how to move and become athletic before you throw them on, a tennis court or a baseball field and start doing that, because there's a lot to be said for you know, just playing and learning how to run and jump and tumble and do all those things that you need to do if you ever have any hopes of getting to an elite level.
Oh, I agree with that. And you know, we could go back through the years and see how many athletes, you know, we've missed putting tennis rackets into the hands of. And you know, I was encouraged recently. I read an article about how 40% of parents now are not going to let their kids play football, you know, because of all this concussion myth that's going on. And it brings hopes and dreams to me that they'll consider putting their kids into tennis now. And I hope that's the case, that they'll look at other sports such as tennis and soccer for sure.
Well, I mean, you know, tennis, soccer, basketball, sports like that that give the kids a chance to you know, just compete and play and somewhat low pressure, low impact. I mean, my background is, you know, as a kid growing up playing baseball and football primarily, you know, tennis was way down the list for me. But, you know, it's there are issues with some of those contact sports. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the kids don't need to play them or at least give them a try. I think we just have to do a better job of positioning tennis as one of those sports that kids play will play as they grow up and as they develop.
Yeah. Now, Bill, I wanted to thank you for coming on and talking about NAI tennis today, but there are other things that you've been doing in the tennis world here, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk about some of these other things that you've been doing, and I went through and looked at your resume here, and I was kind of shocked at what you've been doing. I mean, you're heavily involved with the USPTA and PTR both, which is kind of unheard of nowadays. So how does that work for you?
Well, I kind of go back to the basics that if you want to get good at something, you need to just kind of surround yourself with good people and listen and learn a lot. And early on, I just made the decision that I wanted to be a member of both organizations and take all that I could from both of them. And for the last 25, 26 years, I've been an active member in both of the teaching organizations. All politics aside and all the other things that have gone on in previous years, both of the organizations have helped me to become a better coach and teacher and communicator so that's the way I looked at it. It's not necessarily been an easy road to hoe. I think there's a very few of us out there that are members of both organizations, but I find it to be very beneficial to me. It's been well worth the financial investment and the time, but it's helped me tremendously. And if you're looking at a career in tennis, and I don't know how you couldn't be a member of both organizations and utilize what they have to offer you.
It seems like in Nashville, you're very active in tennis, but in particular in helping some kids there in tennis. Can you tell us about that?
Well, 41 years ago, Nashville is founded on the music industry and the music business, and 41 years ago, a group of tennis-playing musicians and artists and singer-songwriters and producers got together to play some tennis one weekend and raise a little money for some local charities. And, you know, 1973, the Music City Tennis Invitational was born. And about 15 or 16 years ago, I got involved as a tournament director for the event and or for the tournament. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do, my vision was to help it become more than just a tennis tournament and turn it into more of an event that made a greater impact. And I've been very fortunate to work with some awesome people here in Nashville, some very dedicated people like Patsy Bradley, who has been an icon here in the Nashville music scene. And, we've been able to have a tennis event that has gone on now for 41 years that it's raised a little more than $2 million for the local charities, mainly the Vanderbilt Child Development Center. And, you know, it's just it's a fun event that we do in the springtime that through tennis we're able to impact some kids and some lives right here in our community.
Now when you say pro-am, I mean, are you talking about the musician-type pro people here? Are we talking about tennis pros? I mean, how does that work? I'm curious in this.
Well, our event is kind of multifaceted. We have a tennis pro-am that we do where we get the local teaching professionals involved. Years ago, we had an event called the Captain's Cup that was kind of in conjunction with our tennis event. And we had the likes of, Luke and Murphy Jensen come to town. And, you know, we've been fortunate to get some outside people involved in the tournament. But, you know, for Nashville, you know, it's real easy to get the local music industry involved. And, you know, we've been very fortunate to have people like Sarah Evans and Brooks and Dunn and Hillary Scott from Lady Antebellum involved with our tournament because, you know, they live here. You know, a lot of them will play tennis, it's easy to get them involved for such a good cause and helping the kids out at the hospital. It's been a lot of fun to get them involved. But, you know, we do a team event and just play tennis and have fun and raise a little money every spring.
$2 million, that's remarkable, and I know those kids appreciate it, Bill. You're a traveler as well, and I must admit I'm a little jealous of this. Down to the Caribbean, is that right?
I tell people I'm very fortunate. I've been very lucky to make some really good partnerships and have some great relationships with other coaches and people around the globe. And probably for the last 15 years, I've done a number of junior tennis camps throughout the Caribbean. Have a really good relationship with the Trial Club, which is down in Jamaica. We've done an annual summer camp for kids that normally couldn't afford it. We'll come in and we do a one-week summer camp for them and do some other events throughout the year to kind of help, you know, raise the awareness of tennis, raise some money, and also just grow the sport, which is what it comes down to. You know, I think we've all been lucky and fortunate in our professional careers and lives in tennis, and anything we can do to just kind of help grow the sport wherever it is, whether it's in our own community or, you know, 10 miles down the road or 1,000 miles away. I mean, I think that's one of the things we have to do.
Now, something that I read about, and I don't know if you still do this, but caught my eye, something called the Country in the Caribbean. Do you still do this?
You know, that was a real interesting event that kind of dreamed up, and working with Travis Television here out of Nashville, we were able to take down some singers and songwriters to a little island in the Caribbean called Anguilla, and we, for about 3 years, put on this little singer-songwriter showcase on the beaches there. and raise some money for a local organization, the Anguilla Tennis Academy. And, you know, once again, I think when you combine tennis and music, it's an easy fit. And, getting people to go down to the Caribbean to sing songs and play tennis is not a hard sale. very fortunate. We had some really good events down there, and we've got some plans to bring that back here in the very near future.
You need something else. I tell you what. Now, most recently, and this is something that I think just happened recently, the Grips Challenge. Can you tell us about this thing?
Yeah, I've got a really good friend, Aaron Fox, who co-founded the Grips program. And if you've never seen or heard of the Grips program, and you're a parent or a teaching pro, you definitely need to look into it. But the Grips program is basically like the belts that you would have in karate. It's the same concept for tennis, for kids to pass a proficiency test and earn a different colored grip as they move up. And Aaron is a very unique individual and got me involved with a show that they put together, and he wrote. It recently aired on the Tennis Channel. Hopefully people caught it, but it was called the Grips Challenge. It was a family event that was almost a game show type of an atmosphere. And for those that got to see it, I mean, it was a lot of fun to get to work with them on it and be there on set. But it really came off as something fun to watch when it aired on the Tennis Channel, because there's nothing like it that's out there. But I'd highly encourage people to check out the Grips Challenge or the Grips program on the Internet.
Well, the thing I like about, and when we highlighted, Tony Minnis did a show for Inside College Tennis. The thing I like about what the Tennis Channel is trying to do with these shows is these are shows that are coming from tennis people. Tennis people know what a tennis person wants to watch more than anybody else, and so they should listen to us. I mean, it makes sense.
Well, I agree. I agree. There's a lot of good ideas, and there's a lot of talent out there. I think the challenge is getting those people connected with the powers that be at the Tennis Channel and finding ways to make those projects happen.
One of the just hear me out on this. One of the most annoying contests I've seen them run was the hottest tennis coach in America. Now, don't get me wrong, I enjoy looking at a hot tennis coach. There's no doubt about that. But for a tennis teaching person, I could really care less than who's the hottest tennis coach in America.
It's kind of interesting when it first came out. I thought it might die after the first year, but it didn't. I guess I'm still holding out hope that I'm going to make it in the top 10, but probably not.
Now, you also are out there helping juniors with E.
I lost you there, sorry.
I'm sorry. I said you're also out there helping some juniors with your DVDs, and you've got some YouTube videos out there as well?
Yeah, I do. We a year or so ago, I just, was looking around, and the thing that I find, when coaching juniors and working with parents and players, that they come for their lesson, and you go over the things that you want them to go over, and you give them what you can give them in that hour or 2 hour block of time, and then you send them on their way, and you just never know what they're doing out there or how they're practicing or if they're practicing in between their lessons and match play. And with the movement that's been in place the last 3 or 4 years with the 10 and under program, those are the parents that really need the education and needed some help. And so I put together, I worked with a really good director, local lady, Holly Heiss, and we put together, I wrote the script, and we put together some drills that basically, you know, you could go out there and do with your brother or your sister, your mom or dad, just some live ball things that you could go and do and actually get something out of your practice. Because way too often, you know, you look out there on the court and it's a mom and a son or a dad and a daughter, and, you know, they stand in one on each baseline, and they'll hit a ball and they'll chase three, and then they'll hit two balls and they'll chase down four. And, you know, after 30 minutes, they're frustrated and they leave. And those are the good players. So, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us as teaching pros and coaches to find ways to educate, you know, our players not only how to hit a better ball, but how they need to practice and how to go about it. And that's kind of where that DVD came about. Learned a lot about DVDs, you know, you're putting that first one together. So hopefully the second installment will be a little bit better.
Well, it's got to be one of the most frustrating sports around. I mean, we put this great product on TV, you know, four or five times a year that encapsulates the TV audience. They get to watch these heroic warriors do battle 4 or 5 hours, and people just love the sport, and then they go out and they try to duplicate it on the court, and all they do is hit balls over the fence or into the net and chase them down and wonder how did they do that, you know, and they can't figure it out.
And I think one of the things we've got to bring back is the, you know, the importance of kids going out and hitting on a hitting wall. I'd love to see that kind of resurgence in the United States, because there's a lot to be said for a kid just going out and hitting a ton of balls on a hitting wall.
Yeah, no, nobody ever beats the wall, you know. Nobody. Undefeated to this point. Now, the last thing that I researched here about you and the thing I'm interested in this is you also host a radio tennis talk show, or have hosted.
Well,
I did currently do that?
No, we did that for a little over a year. I had a really good friend who's a tennis enthusiast, and he was a producer for one of the top country music radio shows that came out of Nashville. And, you know, we were talking one day about some ideas and things that we both, you know, liked and didn't like about tennis. And, you know, out of that, you know, conversation and a couple of beers, we decided to join forces. And for a little over a year, we did a show out of Nashville, actually aired it on Sunday morning, right off of Music Row. And it was on an AM station, but we also sent it out on the internet. But it was a lot of fun. Was able to, you know, to do some really cool interviews and get some guests on. And we, you know, the show was basically just promoting tennis. You know, we talked a lot about college tennis. We talked about local junior tennis. You know, we always spent time on talking about the pros. But, you know, from top to bottom, our goal was to just, you know, increase the awareness of what was going on in the tennis world. And for a good while there, a lot of fun. Richard Falkland was my co-host, and he produced the show because he had the radio knowledge, and I guess I brought my radio good looks to the table. So we were able to do that for a while.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you for coming on today. It's been a delight in talking to you, and thank you for sharing your small college experience, in particular that NAIA stuff. I've never really understood the NAIA experience, and you've helped clear up some things today.
Well, Jason, I really appreciate the invite to come on. Really a fan of the show, and appreciate what you're doing to grow the sport, you know, through this, and hopefully more and more we can grow the listening audience and to continue promoting tennis.
I look forward to it. And listen, anytime you need some help going down there to the Caribbean, I've looked at those pictures of your events there in Nashville, those Eaton events you got. And anytime, you know, you need some help, you just give me a call.
I'm going to put you on speed dial, buddy.
Thanks so much, Bill. And listen, I hope that, you're right about that weather prediction, and it, you know, we get warmed up here quickly.
It's coming, man.
Well, have a great day and a great week, Bill. Thanks so much for your help.
Thanks, Jason. See you.
Thank you. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Bill Riddle. Bill is an excellent gentleman. Thanks for coming on the air today to help explain that NAIA situation. He is, like I said, a gentleman in doing that. We haven't had a lot of NAIA guests, and Bill was quite successful at that level, running several nationally ranked programs, and he was very successful there in the Tennessee area in doing so. Over 20 years, 25 years plus experience in that arena, teaching arena as well, and so excited that he came on to share some of that today, and look forward to keeping up with him as he continues to teach tennis and help out many communities, not only here in the United States, but also down in the Caribbean. And we'll also want to let you know that next week we've got Mr. Ari Keigel coming on. Ari runs the program down at Barry University, and we're looking forward to having him on. It is a top nationally ranked program, and we look forward to him coming on. So please tune in next Wednesday. That'll be 1 o'clock. And if you're lucky enough to get out and hit some tennis balls, we'd encourage you to do that, particularly you indoor people. You outdoor people, you may have some trouble with the wind or the cold. But if you've got a chance, get out there and do it. And thanks so much for listening in today. Bye-bye.